among the geographer. So it's particularly embarrassing, so sorry. I got okay, so in this talk, I will make several gestures towards a study of what we could call security atmospheres. And I want to do that particularly through these sorts of light writings on spheres. Security, I want to suggest, this is deliberately kind of polemic, does not just simply respond to atmospheric threats. Security produces its own atmospheres. Security becomes atmospheric. Security is an atmosphere. Okay, so I'll try to trace this out in the paper, where I look at a rather peculiar set of material effective relations that might seem quite alien to the study of security. And as I do that, I'm hopefully situating, or I could situate this project with a lot of different work, especially by the authors sitting here in the room today, on the different ways we might think about security in relation to affect, poetics, materialities, security's excesses, security's banalities. So I want to try to think and write security differently by attending to atmospheres as a way to describe security as a kind of morphology, or its morphology, or security as a kind of quality. What is the quality of the security apparatus? And how might we understand that apparatus as something enveloping and overlapping? Overlapping the very world, experiences, and subjects those apparatuses are implicated in producing. So the paper considers Slotsky's sphere's geometry as a particularly powerful trait for understanding these things. Such an approach, I suggest, helps us to attend not only to security spaces and sites or surfaces, or indeed its networks, but instead I want to try to attend to security's depths, its volumes, its fields, security's intimacies, its shapes, and its insides. Now, in the fuller paper, I try to explore these arguments through 8 or 9 different, I suppose, vignettes, through which an atmosphere of security or security atmospheres can be articulated, which I try to theorise. And I'll say a bit more about this in relation to the security dispositif through the paper. So rather than present 8 or 9 different vignettes, I want to rather to actually give a bit more of a theoretical grounding for the issue that I'm trying to do. So in doing that grounding, I want to try to understand atmosphere in relation to a security dispositif through 3 interrelated yet quite contradictory junctions. So first, I want to argue that atmospheres simultaneously describe the spatialities which security apparatus constitute. Thinking through spheres helps us to extrude networks and topologies. To extrude an apparatus into immersive and enveloping shapes describes both the quality of the situation, but which is not irreducible to any one or single thing, it gets to the bits and pieces of a dispositif. In other words, atmospheres can help us attend to the expressive relations of people, thing, and world to comprehend security's relations through much less clear-cut modes of individuation, encounter, and presence. That's the second one. And third, thinking security through atmospheres is also to gain a sense of the multiple spaces of sharing, of dealing individuating the forces that security performs. So Slotsky's notion turns our examination of spheres inwards towards communities of security inside, or rather of being inside or being together, where one is both inside and outside. So think about that relation to another. So that we can think about then not just the inside of an apparatus and what might animate it, but so that we can also ask questions of security of things like, well, how might security talk to questions of love or passion or intimacy? Okay. Let me sketch this out a bit more then. Okay, so I could certainly try to contextualise what I'm doing in some of the more recent writings going on at the moment towards where we might think about security and deeper senses of territory and space, where we might attempt to grapple with security spaces as certain regimes of power or apparatus of dispositives that take a much deeper conception. that take form, kinds of materiality that are spaced out in much more complex and interlocking ways than we might have done before. So particularly the work of I.R. Wiseman, Stephen Graham, Stuart Elgin is doing this at the moment. These might be, or volume may well be, one of the key mediums through which security is performed and upon which it depends. But what might Sloterdijk tell us about this? Well, Sloterdijk provides us with two forms of difference, drawn out in quite extraordinary scope through a range of different theological, scientific, and epistemological contexts. So, for instance, in bubbles, Sloterdijk explores the air and the spheres not simply a biological life support, but we'll get to that in a moment, but as a bipolar medium of the social, pre-social. Bubbles seem to be about human relations that are quite primitive. The sphere describes a level of affective intimacy, a togetherness performed through recurring tropes, circles, walls, wounds, faces, eyes, caves, magic circles. Now, whilst terror from the air, but I think it comes from the second volume of spheres, maybe the third, takes this in a rather different way. It takes rather an inside and an outside of the sphere that is much more convoluted. And yet the focus on the outside and the exceptional is not so convoluted. So what's clear in Terra from the Air is actually how our atmosphere is being taken away from the life in order to kill it. And this is comprehended through various different historical processes whereby the air and atmosphere is explicated in order to punish or ultimately prevent life. So how can the atmosphere kill? So in one sense then, when we have in Terra from the Air, practices of violence rendered literally meteorologically in order to level terror and death. And in bubbles, in the first one of bubbles, something slightly differently. In bubbles, an atmosphere understood not necessarily meteorologically, but understood affectively. And understood much more in terms of insight. And I want to come back to this description a bit later. Because there's other sorts of shapes, and perhaps more detailed ways to try to conceive atmospheres of security and affect. So others have tried to think through ambiences as not necessarily a geometry, or ambiences and atmospheres is not necessarily a geometry like a sphere. So we're thinking affective atmospheres by Anderson has really led the way in geography, seeing atmospheres as shared crystallizations of affect. Although they may well have more lasting consequences, atmospheres interrupt, perturb, disorientate, haunt their shared ground from which feelings and subjects emerge and unfold. Finding some way through rather sketchy writing on atmosphere from across social and political theory, Anderson sees atmospheres by Michel Dufresne as an analogous sense of experience, always in the making, an expressive world which is never finished. And in more depth, atmospheres are qualities. For Dufresne, this quality does not belong though to any one thing or object, but it overspills it. It elicits some manner of response as if a condition, a kind of a priori. Now, elsewhere, an atmosphere attains a qualifying unity of any shape. For instance, with the work of French writer on ambient Jean-Paul Thibault, where ambience cannot be reduced to a sum of isolated objects, discrete signals, successive sensations, or individual behaviour patterns. Quote, something unifies the situation, colouring the whole of the surroundings. Atmospheres, for Thibault, are a pervasive quality that places it alongside with the low language of interpretation and perception, therefore troubles. Our ability troubles representation. Atmospheres confer value on what is perceived and expresses the prevailing emotional tonality. Think about tones a bit later. And as he argues, ambience can submerge or impregnate us. We're caught up in an ambient atmosphere. So through this, we have atmospheres then as exceeding and emanating, difficult to locate, not in objects, not in the environment, but applying to some kind of enveloping situation. Likewise, atmospheres are dynamic and not static. An ambience is setting in, catching on at its peak, disintegrating, deteriorating, and emerging from somewhere, but not irreducible to that somewhere. Well, how might we then try to locate atmospheres in terms of questions of security? Well, clearly there's lots of different examples which show us how security is becoming almost atmospheric in meteorological terms. from ways of governing emergencies to the neighbouring context of burgeoning systems of intelligence gathering and storing. And what most recently did Bauer and Burin refer to such systems as security clouds, constituted by diffused webs of informational connections, which have previously seen data and information lying in disparate silos. What brings these together is what they call the magic of security's instantiation. Whilst, for instance, Louisa Moore used the word magic in the contemplating architecture of what she called the data mosaic, in other forms of data processing, particularly targeting passenger movement across borders. In the whirling and coalescing around possible associations, what we might call an ATMO apparatus. But what if we were to take these multiplicity of bits and pieces that compose security as a less flat topology of disparate and contingent relations and associations and try to thicken and deepen them out? To consider the unity of the apparatus itself, to consider the apparatus as something inhabited and animated, what we might think of as an apparatus atmosphere. So I'm trying to make some kind of distinction. Now, Foucault is not that far away, actually, from this position. And we can compare a few different perspectives as we move from Foucault through the medical apparatus to Deleuze and Deleuze's commentary. We could also, of course, go to other places. So if we take atmosphere literally again, we can look, for instance, in biopolitics to the ways in which an atmosphere is being secured in order to secure the political spaces. So, for instance, this is Boswell Reed's ventilation diagram for the House of Commons in the 19th century. Or, for instance, we could look at the way breath is secured for the community in the emergence of resuscitation practices by the Humane Society in the 18th and 19th century across Europe, where the kiss of life rekindles or restirs through breath the fire within the body. So you have one sense of atmosphere being used as a means to care. But there's other things going on. And of course, thinking about through Foucault, we could also think, of course, about Tennant's management of air and ambient atmosphere in the hospital. But if we look to the birth of the clinic, the dispositif of the medical gaze or intervention does something slightly different, where we see constantly penetrating, ever-decreasing spheres of visibility, an interplay of this envelope trope that I'm trying to evoke, as if saucer-like bubbles are converting one another, the patient or cadaver's surface becomes transparent, when the envelopes that previously discarded become a resource to reveal the whole in relation between the parts. The chaos of the body is furthermore reabsorbed within the geometry of lines and surfaces and volumes, walkers or shrill voices, whisperings, palpitations, rough, tender skin, cries. So in this sense, an apparatus that deals with atmosphere brings the sensible out. It brings the sensible into the volume of the abstract through these sorts of seeing and enunciative machines that Deleuze labels them. But on the other hand, Deleuze looks to Foucault himself to try to tease something out a bit further, to urge us out of the sovereignty of the subject of the body. And he does this by taking Foucault's performance, which becomes, quite ironically, more abstract and yet more effective and seemingly more human. So this is Foucault as an atmosphere. Now, Deleuze, like various others, so for instance, we can look to Brian Massumi and Dean's excavation of Ronald Reagan. Used this example elsewhere, Ronald Reagan makes similar kinds of atmospheric moves according to the student of Deleuze in terms of thinking through a body, what a body is made of, and through the intensities of the body and gesture. What we can look to here is our atmospheres as intensities. Intensities in and through Foucault himself that oscillate between what Deleuze calls the lines of force and the lines of breakage or fracture in his analysis of a dispositif. They are what fills in the space, the go-betweens between seeing and saying, between the invisible and the unsayable. It's closely knitted in and with the others, yet separable. It is internal to the apparatus, variable to the apparatus, whilst also escaping the apparatus. So in the last few minutes that I have left, I just want to illustrate some of these ideas, to give you some instances of this in some respects, by taking the fluctuating radiations of atmosphere and security in St Pancras International and in the London Underground. Although, I should say, in the London paper, I tried to track this through various different kinds of atmosphere. So I looked at welcome, I looked at excessive atmospheres, I tried to look at enthusiastic atmospheres, I looked at sympathy, I tried to look at the atmosphere of encounter, I tried to look at how to write atmosphere. But what I want to focus on just at the end of the talk is how might we be sensitive towards atmosphere as a form of security? So in UK's major cities, passengers are urged what to do should they notice anything that seems or feels wrong by pervasive backdrop posters, instructions, advising public to look out for something. The Metropolitan Police's first programme was Trust Your Instincts, followed by Trust Your Senses, two campaigns which use visual and verbal cues to encourage passengers and public to report. We want you to look out for the unusual, posters explain. What exactly is suspect and not quite right and might prove suspicious, with a bit more digging around, was in other places quite explicitly prescribed, and others were not ambiguous. Now, in Project Griffin, the Home Office's engagement consultancy service to businesses and companies encourages, as we've seen, office and city workers to trust their instincts, their senses, and particularly their knowledge of their place. They're asked to draw upon their experience of knowing the place they are the experts in their workplace, states the Home Office guidance. They are ideally placed there to spot when something is amiss. Now, graphics depicting the care one should take over their belongings whilst travelling in London in crowded places is animated by other sorts of representation, by the jagged lines of a multicoloured explosion reminiscent of a kind of comic strip, reminds us that there is danger lurking around in the crowd and in the city. There is no textual indicator, though, in many of these representations, that being careless over belongings can result in an explosive force. So we might say that we have on the verge of a more ecstatic conception of volume, which also almost flips Spotterdykes. So rather than having volumes that enclose, separate, and limit, rather, for instance, in Gernot Bohm's conception of atmosphere, we have objects and things that radiate presence. Indifference to an inclusive sense of volumetric atmospheres. Quote, this is a volume understood as voluminosity, the power of presence in space. Now, this capacity to become present as atmosphere from a background is critical for the posters and instructions that try to give advice to the public. The difficulty, especially in the busy spaces of the Underground and London's transit network, is how to raise one's message, how to make one's message present. Whether the question or an exclamation mark actually punctures the background of ambient messages is questionable, especially according to Transport for London's research. So, for instance, they conducted work on how our messages are backgrounded, how our posters are received and experienced and attended to. And the problem, as always, is how to direct attention. And TfL conducted numerous in-depth studies, what they call travel depths, into how passengers actually perform looking and seeing and watching. How do they attend to underground information through observation and attempting to hone in what Johnny Nolte might call the secret presence? Now, diary geographer Patrick Murphy has shown that it's actually quite common for passengers to totally forget all of this, to lose this rising, building up, or reducing sense of security. Perhaps that's part of the process, to fail to even realise their presence. So we have to a certain extent struggle to make present in order to make a situation of danger and uncertainty the atmosphere itself present to the numerous competing forms of presence going on. Now, crucially, these sorts of strategies do not rely on the public's ability to discern or deliberate over what they see, but they become in some ways, I think, an eye and ear and a mouth. The act, in many ways, is confessional. It's a drawing out of base desires, suspicions, superficial and instinctive. The public's conscious discomfort or subtle disquiet are to be registered, to be elicited as with Foucault, to something abstract, to something visible, to discourse, to speech, and make that ultimately to meaning. In fact, what is prioritised is the perceptual. Another yellow poster tells passengers to report what catches their eye. The instruction is not centred even on what the thing catching might actually be, but to report it immediately using the intercom placed on most underground platforms. As if the disembodied eyes, ears and lips are separated from the person's ability to consider or decide upon what they can perceive or express, the public is simply the receiver to channel their perceptions to the police to process. So, I think I'm running out pretty over. So just to finish on a quote of thought. As Aradhara and Van Oster put it, these instructions seem to relate action and doing to some sort of input. The emphasis is not on understanding the meaning, because subjects are not supposed to think, but they're meant to act on the basis of some sort of stimulations. Cognition is held back here, I think, reduced to the possibility of sensing the unexpected. And it's now largely better.